So, the organizers asked me to originally to talk about a summary of this meeting. And at one point they asked me to give a summary and a future outlook, but after having heard the talk by Tony Tyson and also earlier talks by Massimo Schiavelli or the JWST, I don't think there's much to say about the future. There's much left to be said about the future. The future looks great. So let's remind us what the conference was all about. It was about applications of gravitational lensing, unique insights into galaxy formation and evolution. Why galaxies and not clusters? Well, because galaxies are much more interesting than clusters. Now, in order to somehow organize this summary talk, I thought I'd go back to the program. In the program, there were certain subtitles. And so I list them here. There were dark matter, outer regions, Harvey-Day, dark matter, halos, inner cusps. Didn't say inner cores, it says inner cusps, so there was some prejudice already in the program. Then there was Harvey-Day of CDM substructure, Harvey-Day of supermassive black holes, stars and dark matter halos, and there were 2 days of synergy. And I thought that this is not really the way to organize the summary talk, and so I'm essentially going to go into some random topics. I do not claim to be in any way complete or fair or unbiased or whatever. You know, I make friends or enemies as I want. That's my privilege here. So the conference was about a lot of things. It was a very broad coverage of topics. Gravitational lensing, yes, as one of the tools, but only one of the tools to study properties of galaxies. We looked at dark matter in galaxies, baryons in galaxies, substructure in galaxies, stuff along the line of sight between us and distant galaxies or distant quasars, the environment of galaxies, namely the clusters, the very high redshift galaxies, the first stars, the epoch of reionization, essentially about everything in modern cosmology, except, of course, Big Bang, because already Paul told us on Tuesday that the universe at redshift of 1500 consisted of dark matter and hydrogen, so there was no Big Bang nucleus synthesis. So, you all know what a galaxy looks like. Stolen this picture from Paul. And the challenge to the people who simulate galaxies is to simulate a galaxy like this. It can be done nowadays, more or less. One needs huge amount of CPU hours. We just heard 300,000 CPU hours for just a single galaxy. One would like to have 10 to the 9 particles inside a halo. And this all is now achievable, impressively achievable. So what comes out if one analyzes the result of such simulations? Let's start with the core, the dark matter-only core. And we've heard perhaps it's not really a power law. It can also be described as well by a surface profile. Nevertheless, it seems to be steep, down to the inner part, which one can resolve. If one takes some semi-analytic solutions, one derives that the density goes as about r to the minus 3/4, which is not too different from r to the minus 1, the NFW profile. R to the minus 1.5 seems to be ruled out. Triaxial shape of halos, they're also triaxial in the center, so gas orbits are not circular, which is important because that implies that the observed physical rotation curve, rotation velocity as a function of radius, is different from the Keplerian value gm over r. Because what you measure is gas on elliptical orbits, perhaps with a finite thickness. And so the so-called first dark matter crisis was based on this density profile with M following from a NFW profile, and that did not agree with the observed rotation curves. Now, the fact that gas is not moving on circular orbits may actually solve this. And as Rob Swaters has told us, asymmetric rotation curves are indeed observed in low surface brightness galaxies, those galaxies which we think are dominated by dark matter only, even in the very inner part. And after some biases are corrected, then investigating the observed rotation curves of these low surface brightest galaxies seems to be compatible with a fairly steep inner slope of the density profile. And if you invert rotation curves to get the density profile, you end up somewhere with a slope between 0 and 1, with 1 not being excluded. And so that may be good news for the so-called first dark matter crisis. Now, Stacy McGough also looked at rotation curves of low surface brightness galaxies. And what he found was that whenever you have a feature in the light, you have a feature in the rotation velocity. And so the question is, why is that? Is it because the light, that is the gas, is dominating the gravitational potential and not the dark matter? That is the story about the dog and the tail. But maybe it's not a dog and a tail. Maybe it's an elephant. Maybe it's the dark matter that is both driving the light, the gas, and also the rotation velocity. Something to, you know, think, something that is not understood. Now, the real core of most galaxies is a core with baryons, and simulations including baryonic matter gas cooling have made great progress in the past years, and so we now can actually study what the density profile in a real core should be. Now, we've used the word conspiracy very often during this meeting, and I'm not sure, I'm not an American, as you know, whether that is politically correct, and note that we've all been taped here. So hopefully that was not too bad.
It's only bad because.
So these simulations indicate that the dark matter and the disk are quite well aligned, and that can be compared with the results from gravitational lensing studies, which seem to indicate that the mass distribution has the same orientation, pretty much the same orientation as the light distribution. The ellipticities are totally different, but the orientation is pretty much the same. The cores get more concentrated due to cooling, ending up with a density R to the minus 2, an isothermal density profile. We've heard about a new model for adiabatic contraction that is kind of interesting. The R to the minus 2, is that solving the so-called H-naught problem from lensing? Well, as we've heard this morning, perhaps not. Lensing, Hubble constant of 72 likes more a profile of R to the minus 2.2 or so, slightly steeper than isothermal. Now, from investigating lensing galaxies together with stellar dynamics from all these surveys, R to the minus 2 seems to be the generic value. Lenses seem to be really isothermal, with just a small scatter, about 5% scatter. Concerning the H-naught problem, as Leon remarked this morning in the discussion, this slope here is a slope between two finite radii, the Einstein radius and the radius where you have the stellar dynamics information. That is not the slope that goes into H-naught. The slope that goes into H-naught is the local slope near the critical curve. And so it's not clear whether, you know, this minus 2 actually also applies for the Hubble constant. In at least one system, the slope must be smaller than 2 because we see a third image. An isothermal profile doesn't give you a third image, so it has to be slightly shallower, or it must have a finite core of about 5 milliarcseconds. Now, at these scales, there must be an influence of a central black hole. The Einstein radius of a 10 to the 8 solar mass black hole is about 20 milliarcseconds, and so that's one of the cases where we can actually study the influence of a black hole. And also in 0218, in a poster by Olaf Vuknet, he shows that O2AT needs a supermassive black hole to suppress the existence of a third image. The contraction due to baryons makes halos rounder, and so that has an influence on the dynamical study of tidal streams, of which we heard some very interesting new results. There's a direct test of the shape of the halos, namely by looking at non-radial motions of hypervelocity stars. Very cute idea. And we've seen impressive data on the tidal streams in M31. Back to the conspiracy. The fraction of dark matter within, you know, one or two effective radii is about one half. Why is it one half? Why is it not 5%? Why is it not 90%? In order to get to that value, gravitational lensing has turned out to be extremely useful, because from purely dynamical analysis, it's not always clear that you get such a value. Okay. The X-ray gas, which has been used in many elliptical galaxies, in several elliptical galaxies, may not be in hydrostatic equilibrium, as we heard from Giuseppe Bertin. And in particular, he said that although there may be now good dynamical evidence for dark matter in massive elliptical galaxies, little is known for small elliptical galaxies. Now, actually, that here we cannot really help, because most of our lensing galaxies are pretty large elliptical galaxies. So it would be interesting to get a sample of lens systems with small angular separation and do these studies there as well. Denis Zaritsky told us about a modified fundamental plane, and he assured us that we may still call it fundamental. It's no longer a plane because it's curved, it's nonlinear. But what is impressive is that on this relation, everything from dwarf spheroidals to the intercluster light seems to fit on for whatever physical reason. Very interesting. Now I spend a few minutes on that topic. As you might have guessed, substructure. Lots of talks about substructure here, and very controversial. So where did the story start? Well, at the end of the 1990s, it was clear that if you have a galaxy-sized halo and you simulate it, you end up with many bound subhalos in such a galaxy scale halos. Pretty much the same as if you simulate a cluster, you find a lot of subhalos in a cluster. Those we see, they are the galaxies, but those we appear not to see, we see not to see. So if we look at the sensors of satellites in our Milky Way, we knew about 10 at that time, predicted were several hundreds, and so this was then termed the second dark matter crisis. By the way, within about a year or two, last year or two, there were 10 new Milky Way satellites detected by Sloan, by covering about 12% of the sky. So maybe if you survey the whole sky, you get to about 100 satellites. But until you know what their velocity is, it's still unclear whether they would fit the predictions. But hey, gravitational lensing has a solution for this problem. We see these dark matter satellites, right? We have flux ratio discrepancies. They are frequent, they're not rare, they're really frequent. And so, if one takes the dark matter substructure as a prediction for lens systems, then in fact you predict the flux ratio discrepancies. And so, you know, we were all happy. However, you need these substructure also to be at the right place. They have to be close to the center of the galaxy. And then, you know, these guys came back and said, sorry, they're not in the center, they're further out. You don't have enough substructure in the central part of the galaxies, and therefore you cannot solve the flux ratio problem. And you have obscure in the center because of tidal disruption. And so, as Ben Moore said on Tuesday, dark matter subhalos cannot explain flux ratio discrepancies. You need 10 times more substructure than you have from these simulations. Now let's start the consideration again, just from a pure lensing point of view. Is substructure involved in lens systems? The answer is a clear yes, for three reasons. In my, as I said, I'm biased. First, there is no other way known to explain the flux ratio discrepancies in the six radio quads that have been looked at. Radio is important because these source components are extended so that the stars do not give you a big effect, so there's no microlensing involved in flux ratio. This, I think, is really the killer argument. In three of those six systems, namely 2045, as we've heard today, 2016, and 0414, substructure is seen. Okay? Substructure is seen in form of a, you know, 1 or 2% light blip somewhere close to the images. If you put the mass at this little blip of light, you get the flux ratios right. And so there must be Magellanic cloud kind of halos in the inner part of these three lensing galaxies that you see. So they are there. Even if the simulators say they are not there, they're further out, we see them. Yeah? And this, you know, most likely is just the tip of the iceberg. And they're not easy to find. The one in 2045 has just been discovered. So one has to really look hard for them, but if one looks hard for them, some of them are found. And third is the difference in the behavior of saddle and minimum images. That's also, I think, a very clear indication for substructure being there. Well, the substructure doesn't have to be in the lens itself. It can be somewhere along the line of sight. But perhaps the expected line of sight lensing is too low. The optical depth for that is perhaps too low, as was shown in a paper by Jacqueline Chen a couple of years ago. Is it CDM subhalo substructure? Not known, but what else? Again, the difference between the behavior of settled points and minima makes a good case for this being lumps of matter. Whether it's CDM subhalos, not known, but lumps of matter. And again, what else? Do we really think that if you make a multiple expansion of the surface mass density that you get a significant contribution from the 31st order moment? That would be substructure. Right? That would be perfect to give you small wiggles in kappa to explain flux ratios, flux ratio discrepancies. And then, as was claimed also privately by Ben Moore, are the simulations that Marussia Bradat has done and reported upon here are just due to pure particle noise? Is the substructure that she sees in the simulation just substructure from individual, more or less individual particle? And of course that would give you effectively substructure. Well, we believe it's not, but that is something, you know, we strongly believe it's not, Matthias, right? We don't. So how do we conclude on this? Well, Marussia gave the conclusion. It's a big mess. No. I think there's one way to actually make some progress. As I said, looking at the substructures that have been found was quite a difficult task. Nevertheless, one can go out and look for such Magellanic cloud type of satellites in other elliptical galaxies and see whether they appear there. Take some telescope time, right? But it's maybe worth looking for them. Perhaps one can also just look at the lens galaxies of doubles, which also have been mapped with ACS, and see whether that one can find some indication for these satellites. That is, look for those elliptical galaxies where you do not need a satellite to explain flux ratio discrepancies and see whether you find them there anyway. And then the question was posed, do we know a single 10 to the 9 solar mass object with a mass to light ratio in excess of 1,000? A dark subhalo, so to speak. The answer is probably no, but how would we find one of those? Right? How would we find an object with a luminosity of 10 to the 5 solar luminosities and still be able to see that it has a mass of 10 to the 9 solar masses? Go to the next topic, galaxy formation and evolution, stars, dark matter, and supermassive black holes. We have been presented with two theoretical views on that. One is sort of a microscopic view, looking at the merging of two elliptical galaxies, so-called dry merger, and then taking a more, you know, larger scale view, global view, take the Millennium Run, which is just pure dark matter, and supplement this with semi-analytical models. So some of the results that I found interesting from these studies are, first, the fundamental plane is conserved in dry mergers. Well, it better is, otherwise it would be hard to understand why there is a fundamental plane at all. The projection of the power of the fundamental plane is curved, so there should be modifications of the Faber-Jackson relation, for example. And it's curved because you have some orbit dependence on the result of a merger. The blue-red bimodality of galaxies, as we see them locally, requires non-stellar feedback. And so AGNs are important for galaxy evolution. And I put an exclamation mark here, because I was reminded recently of a colleague of mine who wanted to set up a journal club. And we got all together and he said, well, what should be the scope of this journal club? Should be, you know, extragalactic astronomy and cosmology, but no AGNs. That was before it became clear, only fairly recently, that AGNs are in fact really important for understanding the evolution of galaxies. We were offered 25 million galaxies in case we need them. Supermassive black holes are predicted to form cores in elliptical galaxies, and it would be interesting to look actually whether we are able to see these cores. I don't know of any result indicating this. And it's the mergers, of course, that drives the dark matter into the cores, which contributes to the conspiracy. Now, at a random place in this talk, let me give you a random selection of additional highlights that I did not fit into any of the other topics. The lens in the cloverleaf has been detected after, 20 years of searching for it. 15 years of searching for it. By now we have detected 4 planets via microlensing, also a real achievement. We've learned that SPH fails. Why is that a highlight? Well, because there are many new papers that can be written that were based on SPH. Cute idea is breaking the meshy degeneracy with lensing of the fundamental plane. The fundamental plane is very tight, and if you have sufficient number of background red galaxies, you know, that may actually be a pretty good handle on breaking the meshy degeneracy. And the cosmic string lens is not a lens. Okay. Well, it's a lensing conference on. It's a galaxy conference, but there's also been some cluster lensing. And cluster lensing is important and nice. It's important because we know that clusters are an important cosmological probe, not only for, you know, lensing, but also for X-rays, for example. And Zinyar Zeldovich coming up soon, and lensing gives us a handle on understanding the mass distribution of such clusters. And second, they are nice because if you see a picture of a strong lensing cluster, you have all these arcs, it really looks impressive. And so there are about now 10 to 20 clusters with strong lensing features, and which are, you know, pretty well known and investigated. And there are far more to come. We have already seen first glimpses of new surveys of clusters with strong lensing features. The best case, arguably, is Abel 1689. It has 30 multiple images. It has more than 100 strong lensing features. It has many long arcs, really long arcs. Jean-Paul reported that there are now 21 redshifts known of multiple image systems. And you have weak lensing from ACS. Now, this is, as I said, arguably the best data set we have on a strong lensing cluster. And because it is such a nice data set, there are at least three serious attempts of modeling. And when I say serious, what I mean is there are three groups who have sat down, worked on this very, very hard, and did a very careful and thorough investigation of these data. I've read two of the papers. The third one probably is not out yet. But that was the work that Jean-Paul reported on. First is by Tom Broadhurst and colleagues, the second by Alexei Hakula and colleagues, and the third reported here by Jean-Paul. And then one of the, you know, first parameters you try to fit is an NFW profile to the mass profile, get the concentration index. And then in the Broadhurst papers, there are three different values for the concentration index, depending on whether you base it just on the strong lens modeling, on the weak lensing, or a combination of strong and weak lens. Highest is weak lensing, yeah. The Hakulite R and the Kneibert R studies seem to come up with, you know, pretty much the same result. Now, here's the point that we briefly touched on yesterday in the discussion section. After you've done the modeling, you have a model for the mass distribution and a model for the source distribution. Then you can map back the source distribution back to the lens plane and compare how well your predicted images fall to the observed images. That's actually what you try to minimize in order to get a best model. And the answer is, it's of order 0.05 arc seconds, as Jean-Paul has said yesterday. For these two studies, it's more of order 1.5 arc seconds. Now, is that a number that should make us happy? And I claim, no, not really. Because each image yields a chi-square of 100 per degree of freedom, a chi-square of about 100. So in a statistical sense, these are not good fits. Nevertheless, if we compare the mass maps from Hakula et al. And Broadhurst et al., they look very similar. So, you know, something must be right about this. So what do we trust, what should we trust from such lens reconstruction? So what is robust? The overall mass profile. Concentration index, or perhaps better, the scale radius. Perhaps the scale radius is better determined than the concentration index. The outer slope, shall we trust that? The mass inside 40 arc seconds, that's probably a very robust quantity. the mass-to-light ratio of galaxies, of cluster galaxies, the truncation radius of cluster galaxies as a function of distance from the center of the cluster. Are these numbers robust? Can that be shown? That, I think, is something that I would be interesting to learn. Or do we actually expect such formally bad fits? Let me say formally bad fits in a chi-square sense. How can we improve on the fits? Are we talking here about a small-scale problem or a large-scale problem? Do we not understand mass distribution on small scales, say, galaxy scales? Or is it something that has to do more with the overall profile of the cluster mass? Is there unseen substructure that we cannot model because, you know, we don't see it? Is the discrepancy on the concentration index only due to the parameterization of the mass profile? Do we have to worry about a Meshy degeneracy? Maybe not with so many redshifts. Can we trust cosmology from strong lensing in clusters? By that I mean the distance ratios of multiple images. Now I think these questions are important, because in 10 years from now we'll get data from JWST. We will have 10 times as many strong lensing features in a Bell 1689, and if we don't learn how to improve on the mass models, these additional 90% of strong lensing features, this additional factor of 9 strong lensing features, will not yield us more information about the mass distribution in clusters. So we have to learn how to deal with these problems. We have to learn how we can make even formally better mass models, or understand why we are not able to do this. More on clusters. 7 out of 10 redshift 0.2 X-ray selected clusters show substructure. They are not relaxed. What are the implications of such a finding for cosmology from X-ray clusters? Well, most of the X-ray people would probably claim that most of the information from X-ray clusters does not come from the inner 100 kiloparsec core, but more the global X-ray emission from clusters. Does the bullet cluster prove dark matter? Yes, of course. But we believed in it anyway, right? We don't have to be really convinced. But what about the other camp? So, wish you all the best, Doug. Two topics. Gravitational lensing as a convenience, namely as natural telescopes and as natural beam splitters. Looking for high redshift objects behind clusters has by now become more or less a standard method. The factor of 2 or 3 or 5 or 10 in some cases really brings you a lot if you look at, you know, very faint sources. We can investigate star formation at high redshifts, redshift 6 or 9, even higher with JWST. JWST will most likely make a surge of high redshift objects behind foreground clusters. Blind spectroscopy search along critical line has turned out to be successful. We get, perhaps with JWST, a view of reionization, slightly different phrase, the last big parties of baryons where they all did something together. So clusters, natural telescope, can support the first light machine. And it has been done extensively. For example, a lot of the detailed Lyman alpha forest studies have been done with the quasar 1422, because you just make use of the factor of 30 or so that you get in magnification. And the same is true for Lyman break galaxies. For example, CB58, as we've seen, had the best spectrum of all Lyman break galaxies. By now there's another one which is even brighter. For the beam splitter, that is looking at the absorption lines along two lines of sight, either to the same quasar, that's gravitational lens, or to a close pair of quasars. One investigate the transverse correlation of observers, particular for C4, which has a small coherence scale. The multiply imaged quasars are of particular use. What I found interesting, and I wasn't aware of that before coming here, that peculiar motion of gas has been directly discovered, both in terms of super Hubble flow expansion, namely from Lyman alpha clouds, which is sitting on the edges of bubbles, and bubbles expand faster than the overall universe, as well as gravitational collapse on small scales. Very interesting. Cosmology from strong lensing. We had one talk that was specifically targeted on this, and actually had the same title by Chuck Keaton. And essentially, here's the philosophy. In earlier times, there was the belief that if you take the observed frequencies of lenses and you supplement it with the mass function of objects, of galaxies, you learn something about the density parameter. You can revert this, namely take the lens frequencies, take the view that we know from WMAP and other experiments that we know the density parameters well enough, and then learn something about the mass fraction. And if you do that as a function of redshift, you learn something about the mass function as a function of time. What about the Hubble constant? One approach is you take the time delay, you measure the time delay, you assume something about the mass profile, about your lens model, and you get the Hubble constant. Also here you can take a different view, namely you assume that you know the Hubble constant, then you measure the time delay, and you learn something about the mass profile. And I think there, both of these approaches are currently still pursued. One can get an upper bound on the Hubble constant by making the assumption that mass follows light. It's very, very difficult to imagine that the mass can be even steeper than the light, that the dark matter can be steeper than the baryons. And so from that, you can get a useful upper limit on the Hubble constant. Now, what is the difficulty in following this first approach? We've heard a number of talks on this today. The problem is a problem of, at least to a large degree, a problem of environment. Because environment adds to the surface mass density and the shear in addition to the main lens. And that is, you know, usually called the mass-shear degeneracy. And it's there whether you like it or not. Now, there's matter between us and the lens, and between the lens and the source. It is that matter that the weak lenses are interested in. And the RMS surface mass density, equivalent surface mass density, is about 5% for source redshift of order 2 and 3. So that's, you know, immediately that you cannot break the Mass-Shear degeneracy to better than 5% unless you do the very tedious work that Anne Zapletoff was reporting about. You really try to investigate the line of sight by very careful, detailed, and time-consuming spectroscopy. Now, an RMS doesn't tell you the whole story. It's a highly skewed distribution. So it's very unlikely that you go through a very underdense part of the universe, because voids are not particularly underdense. Whereas if you go through a group, you are really overdense. And so this is a highly skewed distribution, and that has to be taken into account. Structure on the line of sight between us and the lens and between the lens and the source is no worse than structure in the lens plane itself. In fact, one can show that it's totally equivalent, as long as the structure is linear, that is, that you can describe it by pure shear and surface mass density on the scale where you have the images. So it doesn't make the Mass-Shear degeneracy worse than it is anyway. Are lenses situated in random line of sight, as assumed? Well, there are two selection effects, namely a magnification bias and a delta theta. Okay, so if you have additional convergence along the line of sight, you get a higher magnification, which in particular important for bright optical quasars, and you increase your image split. Now, after Dan quoted me, I think I have to pay some tribute to arc statistics. I'm not confirming this quote. Okay? I'm not denying it either. So, what Dan has shown in his talk this morning was something I haven't seen before, namely that one really uses the images of the HDF, the size and the shape of the distribution of real sources, and trace them through a meta-distribution, through a cluster. And I think that removes the largest weaknesses of earlier studies, which have assumed that sources have a constant size. And we know that galaxies at high redshifts are very, very small. In addition, observational effects have been taken into account, in particular the point spread function and the noise from your images. Now, if arcs are defined as length to width ratio of larger than 10, of course a PSF makes a huge effect if you have very small sources. Now, the fact that they can be taken into account removes a second worry that I have. And so, I wouldn't say that anymore if I had ever said it before. However, there's one aspect where I'm not clear how serious that is. Namely, baryons are important. Baryon cooling is important in clusters. And since the arcs occur in the very inner part of clusters, in the inner 100 kiloparsecs or so, understanding the mass distribution, including the baryons, is essential to get the theoretical distribution for it. Cosmology from weak lensing. Well, after Booth's talk, I think I can summarize this in single words. Yes, of course, we expect that weak lensing will give us great cosmological information, in particular about the dark energy. Perhaps it's the most promising method to learn something about dark energy, as was the conclusion of the Dark Energy Task Force. There's some technical issues that need to be solved. For example, understanding, correcting for the PSF, photometric redshift, model predictions. We do not have sufficiently accurate model predictions to analyze future dark weak lensing surveys, but that can be overcome. There are a few financial issues as well. We need to find money for all these very nice experiments that will come. The STAT project has been mentioned twice before, and let me just re-emphasize that, because that's a project that I think should serve as a role model also for other communities. So what happened in the STAT project is that many of the active weak lensing groups got together, got a set of simulated images, and try to measure shear on these images by doing the PSF correction. Yeah? And as Richard has shown you, there was actually a paper published by the STAT project. One is published, one is submitted. And the amazing thing is that there were some groups whose results were totally off. Right? Totally biased results. And they still agreed to put their points in the paper and their name on the paper. I think that is quite remarkable. And I could imagine that doing such a test in other communities would be very helpful and insightful as well.
So this is awesome, not to.
Okay, I'm coming to the end. I've been one of the coordinators of this conference, as you saw the name of the five coordinators. The fact that I'm giving the summary talk immediately tells you how much impact I've tried to take on the program, because no sane person would assign himself or herself this task. And so I can only speak for myself, but probably what I say is not too wrong. This conference has been overwhelmingly most organized by Tommaso and Leon, and it has been a wonderful conference. And so let me use that opportunity to just thank the two of you for this great hospitality, the great organization, the wonderful catering, and taking care of us. Thank you. I can probably speak for all of you. We not only thank you, thankful for Tommaso and Leon, but for all the people who took care of us here locally by organizing this, by writing us emails and, you know, reading the wishes from our eyes, so to speak, our needs, the catering, I don't know, the bus transfer from and to the hotel. Thank you very much.